about a little love and existentialism today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
There are several reasons to choose this particular topic for the day. One, you know, it being as this episode comes out, some of you may not listen, I understand, when it first come out. You have other priorities. I don't know what those could be, but whatever. As it comes out, it is the month of love, you know, February. Everyone celebrates that month, both for Valentine's Day and my birthday. It's a little bit appropriate because of that. But that really has nothing to do with the reason for this topic. I finished not too long ago. I did put it off for a while. It's been a little while because we did the series on 10 commandments or 10 maxims for believers. And so that's, you know, 10 weeks worth. So I put it off that long and included a few little hints of what this would be about in those. But anyway, I read recently another book by Hannah Arendt, and she's my favorite author, obviously. I'm being mocked here in the studio for her being my Valentine or something instead of my wife. That's not true. And she's dead, so that there's that, you know, Hannah Arendt, that is. Yes, Hannah Arendt is dead, so there's that. Anyway, the point is that I am always impacted by her books. They're pretty potent, and for a reason. She is a somewhat of a prophetic voice, and I don't mean by that in spiritual terms, but I mean she speaks to social interests, to political interests, economic interests, and religious, and moral, obviously, and that's one of the biggest ones, in pretty profound, clear, precise ways that I just don't find anywhere else. So I am really grateful for everything God did through her to write these books, to give us this literature for us to think about. So anyway, I read recently from her something I should have read a long time ago, a book called Love and St. Augustine. I'm from the South, though. So Love and St. Augustine. So anyway, the point is, her book, this book is like her dissertation. I mean, it was her dissertation, and then she worked on it in different iterations to get it to the point where it could be published and this was while she was living in America, that it was published. So later, she worked on it in the 1960s and 70s and so on. She had originally, though, worked on it in the 1920s. And, you know, because of that, it's almost hard to believe how insightful this work is, including the way that it would illuminate our understanding of those horrors from the mid-20th century, when in truth the basis to the book was already underway before the Holocaust happened. So I said the 1920s, I think it's the 1920s and 1930s that all of that's going on, that she's working on all of this and then ends up with this work that she then edits through the 1960s and 70s and so on to produce this book. It's a really fascinating read. If you love Augustine, then, you know, you just almost have to read this to see how she takes it. I read her book, and then I went back and read Confessions, Augustine's Confessions. I should have already gone back and read Augustine's City of God again, but I haven't done that yet. But I did read Confessions again, just to put some of this in a sharper context based on what I read from her. So anyway, I put off talking about it for a long time because there's a lot to synthesize in what's going on with it, and because we were doing other things along the way. this is not a book review. So I'm not, I wouldn't want you to think that I'm coming at this and saying, let me just explain to you everything Hannah Arendt says in this book, or even let me evaluate this book for whether it's good or bad. I would never presume to evaluate her books anyway. They're all good. The point is, it's not a book review. And so as I talk about anything that touches on either Augustine's Confessions or her love in St. Augustine, I am not saying this is everything that book means or here's a precise interpretation of it. I read them and I was synthesizing them in my own way of understanding the world as I was reading them. And they've had an impact on me. And because of that, I think not unrelated to the meaning that's in the book, in each of these works, I've come to some conclusions that I want to share that I think are worth spending some time on. So, first of all, in an introductory fashion, I just kind of want to make sure we understand who we're talking about and what kind of input we're talking about from each of these authors. Now, really, the primary source for everything I'm going to be saying later is Arendt. But her source for that book, Love and St. Augustine, is Augustine. And so I need to talk about him for just a second so we have a sense of where this comes from in her. I am not an Augustine scholar. I'm not. I've never been an Augustine fan. I will admit his works are better and better every time I look at them. So it's on me that I'm not a fan of him, not on him. But there's a lot. You know, I have a humanities PhD, and there's a lot of criticism of Augustine in the world of humanities, some of it for good reason, because some of the consequences of his way of seeing the world, especially in his later writings, is pretty harsh and I think worthy of some criticism and some reevaluation on whether it should have been followed or not. But anyway, that's down the road and that's secondary to what we're talking about today. So in talking about him, I'm going to say this part from the Confessions primarily. And this part is just obvious. Everybody knows this about Augustine. If you're into Augustine, if you know Augustine, you're already going to know this. But he is extremely strongly Platonic. And I mean by that dualist. And I will clarify what I mean by that. Meaning, as he looks at the world, the distinction between the things that are eternal and temporal is front and center constantly. He lives in the tension between that eternal realm that we should be focused on and the temporal world, the one bound by time that's right in front of us. It's just built into everything he says and does. And for anybody who knows Plato and Augustine, you know that's Platonic. That's Plato. That he's the one who gives us that sense. And he gives us that sense, that dualistic understanding of the world, particularly with one concept, two words, that play strongly, this is just one way of describing it in Plato's terms, but by the time you read it in Augustine, and then especially in Hannah Arendt interpreting Augustine, it's more than interpreting, it's using his material to draw her own conclusions. The concept of being versus becoming is front and center, as front and center as the contrast between the eternal and temporal in everything about Plato. So being and becoming in Plato is an important distinction also, not as central. Well, I mean, it is. It's just not always the vocabulary that's used, as it will be when we're talking about Arendt. But in Plato, that distinction is really key. And I find it's funny when I teach Plato in an introduction to philosophy class, for instance, or something like that. When I teach him, students will often get this backwards because what Plato talks about is a world of being, or what he describes is something like a world of being and a world of becoming. And I will say to them, you know, which one is which? You know, which one is heaven, the eternal, and which one is here? And most of the time, students will think the world of being is the one that's here. I say most of the time, normally, because common sense says, well, this is the one that is. You know, we're here right now, so this must be the world of being. And the world of becoming, that would be, you know, the one we're going to end up in. But we're not there yet, so it must be becoming and not being. But that's so backwards from even what we should think ourselves in common sense terms. Everything in this world is changing. Everything. Not a little of it, not like we change, but there's a fixed background behind us. Everything is changing. Even the fixed stars that we use as a metaphor for eternity, my slight reference to astrophotography, you know, being included now, even those are exploding. We're having supernova and seeing things change in the universe every day. It's inevitable that everything in the material world, in the world in which we actually exist right now, is changing constantly. Changing is becoming. You are something and you are becoming something else. You're in a constant process of change in this world. It is heaven. And I'm saying heaven generically and broadly as the place where all the permanent things are, the things that will never give way, the things that endure forever, where immortality could be a reality and so on. All of those, that's a world of being. Things aren't becoming something else. They just are what they are. It leads to all kinds of philosophical problems, all kinds of problems for vocabulary and theology, questions about passibility, questions about meaning, questions about whether God can have emotions, questions about immutability, what it means for God to be immutable. If he's immutable, how can he have a sense of anger at one moment and happiness another moment? Or are those moments, or is his eternal nature, is he even outside of time, or is he just eternal inside of time? You know, those kinds of things. All those kinds of discussion points, they're really important. I sound like I'm just making fun of them. They're really important, and they're valid. I love the topics. I enjoy them in philosophy of religion. I enjoy them in philosophy proper. But all those questions rise around the concept of being in contrast to becoming. When something simply is, for it to be real, that thing has to persist. There's something permanent about it. And that world of being, heaven or the eternal or whatever it is what Augustine, in this case, Plato before, would have us focus on. It's the thing we ought to see. It's the light behind the cave, if you've read Plato's cave allegory in the Republic. That's the thing that we ought to focus on, not the shadows against the wall. That's just the world of becoming. You get the idea. And so Augustine focuses on that just like Plato does. And so in Christian terms, in Augustine's terms, this, you know, really early, super influential, church father, Augustine, his distinction becomes and it doesn't stay here. It's not only here. I am being a little simplistic. It's just introductory material. But the Christian heavenly and worldly distinction is that distinction. It's the distinction between the world of being and the world of becoming. And nowhere in Scripture that I can think of is that clearer than in 2 Corinthians 4. At the end of that chapter, 2 Corinthians 4, it says, "So we don't lose heart," after he describes all these trials and stuff, "though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self," so wasting away is something perishing, so it's becoming something that it wasn't before, "our outer self," and we all know this, bodies decay, right? So that's not hard for us to understand. "Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day." This concept of the inner world and our, you know, like in Hannah Arendt's language in a different book, it's the life of the mind, you know, that the thing that's inside, whatever that soul is that we have. And so in Paul, as he talks about it, he makes this sharp distinction between the outer self, the shell, this body. And again, outer, inner, it's a metaphor. It's not like the soul is inside and the skin is outside. The soul is more like our blood than like our skin. It's not like that. It's a metaphor for what we understand to be distinct about a body that we can see and touch, that we think of as a shell around a soul that has this eternal nature to it. And so anyway, in Paul's language again, in 2 Corinthians 4, he says, "Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day." It's got something. Now, we're people, we're not God, so we don't have the same immutable nature that God does, but he's given us some kind of nature that, rather than decaying and growing weaker, is somehow persisting. In a world of becoming and decaying, there's something inside of us that isn't necessarily decaying. In fact, it might be getting stronger all the time our body is getting weaker. That means it has to belong to some fundamentally different kind of world than the way we think of this world of becoming where everything decays. I'm giving, that's a lot of interpretation for just one verse. That's verse 16 in 2 Corinthians 4. But I'm making the point of how Paul uses very Platonic, dualistic language at the end of this chapter to make a point about our relationship with God and how we grow in him. So anyway, he goes on in verse 17 to say, because this light momentary affliction, so the trials that we go through in the world of becoming, in this world, the material world, for this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Many of you know the name of the C.S. Lewis book, this compilation of his lectures that he did anyway, or radio talks or whatever they were. As we look not, Paul goes on to say in 2 Corinthians 4, to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. So the things that are seen, they're in this world. The things that are unseen, that's what that inner man that we have is able to see, but not with the physical eyes that we have, but in some way with soulish eyes, we're able to look to the heavens themselves or to something that's eternal. And so he says in verse 18, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. So, I mean, it's hard to miss the point. There is a world of becoming and changing and decaying and all the stuff that is this material world that's around us. And then there is something eternal, and that's what we ought to have our eyes trained on. And so with that kind of distinction being made by Paul, and Paul's not strictly Platonic. There, he goes back and forth. Sometimes he sounds pretty Aristotelian in his reasoning. Sometimes he sounds Stoic or even Epicurean. There's a lot of philosophy going on in Paul, and he's trained. He's a trained philosopher and thinker, so he knows what he's doing. He even refers to Stoics and Epicureans. Luke, in telling the story in Acts, brings them up, you know? And in reading the book of Philippians, which is a very Hellenistic environment, it's a Roman colony, Paul is using reasoning that the Epicureans and Stoics would have used. So anyway, all that's separate. To make the point, I'm not saying Paul is purely Platonic or dualism is the biblical view of philosophical reality. I'm saying there is a really strong presence of that kind of dualism in Pauline literature in the New Testament, and I think beyond Pauline literature. I don't think it's that hard to recognize that it goes beyond Paul. Anyway, the point is that distinction between being and becoming is a Platonic distinction. It comes from Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, and 600, 700 years after Plato in Augustine, because Augustine was a dualist. I mean, he was always dualist. He was a Neoplatonist and a Manichaean, and then finally takes this position as a Christian Platonist in the things that he describes in the Confessions and following. In his conversion, he takes up this form of Platonism that's actually Christian. And so, and again, I'm not being critical of him. We all have, a worldview that we bring into our Christianity, and it shapes the way we describe and talk about it, and that shaped his. And he never changes from that. He's always got that kind of dualism built into his way of thinking about the world. So if you want a different expression of that, the eternal versus the temporal, or in this case, the being versus the becoming, there's also form and matter. Those two ideas, very Platonic concepts, form versus matter, meaning like in Plato, this creates a serious problem that he doesn't resolve, and it becomes the basis of Aristotle, Plato's student, having a different philosophy than Plato. But the point in form versus matter is that the forms are jokingly, we say it this way, sort of jokingly, it's also accurate though, we say it this way, the form is tableness. Not a table, but tableness, what it means to be a table, you know? And I don't just mean it has to have four legs and a flat surface, but I mean all the things that come together to have the, whatever the meaning, the eternal understanding of what the nature of a table would be. Again, I realize how absurd all of that kind of discussion is. Who cares about the eternal nature of a table? But as an example, it's saying tableness is the form. It's the definition. It's the eternal reality of what a table. If all the tables in the universe were destroyed, tableness would still be what it is. In fact, we would know there were no tables because we would know what it is to be a table. hey, we're having a good time, right? Can I get some beatnik clicks here to go along? Okay, so anyway, I know what tableness is. Tableness. Anyway, so there's that is the form. The matter is the material instantiation of that form. So a table, the one sitting in front of me at which I'm speaking, which is actually more like a desk, but could be used as a table. Anyway, the point is there's form and there's matter. And the problem for Plato, and so I don't think he doesn't see this as a problem. He just leans right into it. But for anybody after him, and certainly in our world, we look back on it and go, that doesn't seem really rewarding for this reason. If you take something more important, like the topic of Arendt's book that we're going to be talking about in a moment, or maybe in the next episode, based on the rate at which I'm going through this, the point is that if you take the topic of her book, Love, which is Love and St. Augustine, you know, that's the whole thing. That's the name of the work. If you take love, then the form of love is eternal. It's in the heavens. That's where the real value of love is. That's where the thing that love actually is. That's why Plato's vision or view of the world, his philosophy, is referred to as realism, because that's not just a concept that we have in our minds so that we can think about what love really is in the material world. That wouldn't be what love actually is. Love is the form in the heavens that's eternal and never changes. It's not just some instantiation of it in the world. You fell in love with somebody and started drooling. That's a nice instantiation of love, but it's not love itself. Love itself is the eternal disembodied reality that could never, you know, and so on. That's the idea. I think you can probably hear the problem that comes with that is that when you talk about the relationship between form and matter, not only this, there's a huge metaphysical problem with that, because form is a substance, matter is a substance, and substances are inherently independent of each other. I know I'm doing a bunch of philosophical mumbo jumbo right now, but for people who like philosophy, you know what I'm talking about. And so they can't interact, but they do seem to interact. And so he makes up, you know, an explanation. The way we translate it and say it is form participates in matter. Matter participates in form, but participates doesn't really have any clear definition, except that there is an interaction where there shouldn't be able to be an interaction, right? So anyway, the way that plays out with something like love, though, is this, that when you love someone in this world, you're only experiencing the materialization, the instantiation of love in the world. It's not the reality of the love. And so really, whether it was that person or another person, and you can hear how impersonal that would be if you tried to include it in a wedding ceremony. Do you, whoever you happen to be, love you, whoever you happen to be, or anybody else that could have been here also, commit yourselves to love one another in whatever instantiation you happen to be in right now. I mean, it's just almost arbitrary, and there some of that plays out in Plato's Republic in ways that are quite uncomfortable. All of the people of marrying age are married to all of the other people of marrying age in a certain year, and those people just are all married to each other. You know, that's weird, and it's never fully realized, thank heavens. In the world. And Plato, you know, gets mocked a little bit for that, and other people sort of disdain him for that, but it's a natural outflow from his philosophy. Anyway, that point's not where I want to stick. The point is, by the way, when we use the word platonic and we say, what's a platonic relationship? All we mean is, well, they don't do anything physical. But what that means is their relationship is the eternal kind. It's the spiritual kind. It's the non-material kind. In a dualistic sense, it's not something that would be manifested in a marriage and children. It would be manifested only in the brilliance of the conversations and interactions that they have, or the concern that they have one for another non-materially, and so on like that. Okay, so the way that turns into a problem for Christianity, at least in my view, and you know, a lot of people would agree with me on this. There are some people who don't, obviously, because it is played out. The way that becomes a problem for Christianity is when our view of the eternal or the world of being or the world of forms becomes so important to us that the only way we can think about this world is with disdain. The only way we can think about the material world is somehow to reject it completely. There's some of that built into Augustine's Confessions. revealing how guilty he feels that he actually sometimes enjoys his food. You know, I eat because I need to eat so that I can live and do the things I'm supposed to do. And sometimes I realize that I've gone too far and actually enjoyed my food. That's not the exact wording of the quotation, but it's pretty close to that. And I understand it, you know, when you're young in your faith, and he's not like a novice in his faith writing the Confessions. But he does grow, and there are more mature writings that he has later, so I'm picking on a certain version of his statements, and only trivially. It's not like the worst thing for a person to say, I think I need to enjoy my food a little less. A lot of us could enjoy our food a little less and probably be in a better place. Okay, enough apologizing for my own criticism of Augustine. Anyway, the point is, the way this comes out into Christianity in some not-so-helpful versions I'll give two versions of it, and it comes in the form of asceticism and abstraction. Those are the two versions, asceticism and abstraction. Asceticism meaning a denial of any possible pleasure in the world or anything even remotely acknowledging that there's value to the material world itself. So, I mean, there were early ascetics who refused to shower, which just seems to me like a form of not loving your neighbor. But whatever. But also denying meals, only eating what would absolutely be required in order to survive and so on like that. That kind of self-denying asceticism is one of the characteristics that doesn't have to be attached to this, but it can emerge out of a view of the relationship between the temporal and the eternal that ends up inherently disdaining the temporal. In sort of a simplistic sense, we often associate that with Gnosticism and just say, oh, well, that's a Gnostic tendency and so on like that. It's actually, I think, more complicated than that, and it is a symptomatic of a lot more of Christianity than just something that would be Gnostic or fall into the sort of metaphysical dualistic errors that others fall into. In this case, the asceticism I'm talking about emerges from a sense that the only thing we can reasonably focus on as people who now know God, the being of all beings, the one who says, I am that I am, that one, the only way we can properly focus on that is not to see anything else. So denial of anything of value in this material world becomes an aspect of that. Sometimes, I'm not saying it has to or intrinsically does, but sometimes it does. And in the same, and by the way, it doesn't have to be full bore. I'm moving to a monastery and now I'm never going to shave or cut my hair, or, you know, my knees are going to grow calluses because I spend all of my time, you know, neglecting the material world and living only for the eternal. Doesn't have to become all of that. Sometimes it is as simple as mocking certain things or certain practices only because they are material, because they do enjoy, I mean, they do involve enjoyment in this material world. And that can be unhealthy in a lot of different ways, and including spiritually. And I'm pretty particular about what I say is tolerable spiritually. Anyway, self-denial can be one of those, and asceticism that goes along with that, or asceticism can be one of them, and the self-denial that goes along with that. The other side of that is abstraction, where, you know, we take everything that, you know, God says to us in Scripture, and we abstract it from being able to realize it in the material world. And so we convert a command to love in this world into a behavior of isolation from the very world we're supposed to love. Doing that is not good enough. Christianity has a form in it in the New Testament, obviously in the New Testament. Christianity has a form in it that requires being in the world. It's not, oh, I'm sorry, you're still stuck in that material world, but you know, I got to get you cleaned up before I bring you to heaven. That's not the New Testament depiction of this. He could do anything he wanted with our redemption. But from the beginning, the point has been the redemption of creation itself. And even if you take that creation to be solely focused on humanity, which it's certainly centrally focused on humanity, even if you take it that way, God chooses to practice his redemption by sending his son into the world in order to bring about our redemption, to become a man himself, and then says to us, after the ascension of his son, after the resurrection, he says to us, you are in this world as I was in this world. You are me in the world right now. That means there has to be more to being here than us simply looking for a way to ignore the material world around us. So the Platonic distinction that can emerge from Plato or later from Augustine. Now, again, Plato's not Christian. I know that, but Augustine is certainly Christianizing Plato's philosophy, and so are taking a lot of his philosophy and, if not fully baptizing it, at least immersing it in his own understanding of what Christianity needs to be fully realized philosophically and so on. All of that said, I'm just trying to make the point, it is easy for us, if we hold that strongly dualistic understanding, only the eternal matters, the temporal world doesn't matter at all, it would become easy for us to pretty immediately disobey God's commands regarding the very things we're supposed to do in this temporal world. So we want to be careful not to do that. And I'm not saying that just to pick on Augustine in introducing this whole topic today. I'm saying it because that question, how do we become more and more diligently committed to caring only about God and eternity and the love that we're supposed to have for him and our hearts being sealed for eternity? How do we become more and more like that all of the time while we're being commanded throughout Scripture to become better and better as a neighbor, to become more and more to become wiser and wiser, that is, as those who are obedient to the word and living it out in this world? How do we love individuals in the world that's right in front of us? How do we love people who are standing right in front of us better and better throughout our lives while at the same time letting go of that very same world? That's a real tension. That's a problem. Augustine wrestles with it in the City of God, and Arendt is wrestling with it. That's a different book that he has, and Arendt is wrestling with it in this work. And that's the other essential work that I would mention here, by the way, in Arendt's work on love and St. Augustine. The other work that she's definitely referring to throughout is the City of God, or using as a resource. And in particular, too, there are a lot of phrases in that work. There are a lot of immediate contrasts in that work that support what she's writing about. But two in particular that Augustine includes in the City of God that are worth mentioning here as we're just introducing the topic today. Number one is the difference between caritas and cupiditas. I brought this up not too long ago. I know they're Latin words. It's not like I speak fluent Latin, but, you know, these are words everybody uses. Caritas, charity. Caritas, love, selfless love. You know, agape is the way we would say it, referring to the Greek version of the word. It's more than that, and it's not just a translation for that word, but that's good enough to get to our point. So Christian love, or charity, as it's translated in the King James, caritas versus cupiditas. And cupidity, you know, that one's not hard. We use the actual Latin word as the base of an English word, cupidity. So lust, wanting things for yourself. It's not always or necessarily evil the way we use the word lust. It is desire, though. And both of these words are desire. Caritas and cupiditas both entail desire. So it's not about the competition between desire and then being sterile of any desire. That's not it. It's the object of desire that's different. There's something about cupidity that involves a selfish desire. And again, every desire has the self involved in it. You want the thing, right? That's what it is. But these are different. Cupidity has built into it something about that desire being consumable, something that you are benefiting from, and that's why you care about it. We'll talk more about the term later on. Caritas, and we know this about love in the New Testament, agape, the way, again, we describe it with the Greek word and so on, Christian love, charity, is love for God. I mean, pure and simple, plain and simple, it is love for God. It's the ability to love something outside of yourself more than yourself. So that caritas is opposed to cupiditas. So that those, you know, charity, selfless love, and that's not the right way to say it for Augustine or even for Arendt right now. It will be later for Arendt. But right now, charity versus cupidity, that's one of the contrasts. So natural human love on the one side and divine love on the other side. That's how we're contrasting them. The other phrase, or an actual phrase in this case, Is this so? The way that I've seen it translated, or the way I've heard seen the phrase used before, is "my love is my weight." which sounds strange, but "my love is my weight." The actual phrase, I think, the Latin phrase is "pondus meum amor meus." So so ponder, weight, you know, weight, the weight of me, my weight, amor meus, is the love of me, right? And what it means is the thing that it's so I think of it like gravity, the thing that draws me towards something. That's the thing that I love. Or more importantly, the thing that I love is the thing that draws me towards something. Whatever it is I love, that's what tells you what my ultimate motivation is. What's really going on with me? What's the weight of my life? And my love is my weight. So all of those of you who are listening who do theology at all, you're thinking Augustine, Aquinas, and the really obvious connection that they create with the beatific vision, for instance, the realization that, and I'm about to give normal words to this for those of you who don't love theology and don't love all that vocabulary. I get it. It doesn't mean you don't know other things. You know other things I don't know. That's fine. I'm just saying in the world of theology, people use that language all the time to make the point that if, you know, when we love food or when we love accomplishment or fame or, you know, whatever it is, and we pursue that, that's what leads to sin. And the error is that our good, the thing we desire, is the wrong thing. It's not that we're working towards it in the wrong way. It's that we're trying to get to the wrong thing. And until those artificial deities, those gods that we worship as self-satisfaction or whatever, are put out of the way and something else draws our attention, meaning God himself, when he puts himself in front of us, shows us himself, and we realize that that's what we actually love, then we start doing the right thing. My love is my weight. The thing that I love is the thing that is going to draw me to it. That's what this is about. And therefore, all my behaviors are going to be shaped by that love. That's the concept behind that phrase, pondus meum amor meus. My love is my weight. That's the idea. Okay, we're only doing introduction. I spent most of my time introducing the Platonic ideas that are behind this. Let me give you just a little bit of an introduction to Arendt and why she would write a book about Augustine's works in the Confessions and the City of God, why it would be important to her. She's not a Christian. She, although when you read her writings, especially this one, it's not like she shies away from Christianity as a basis for what she's trying to see fulfilled. It's a very interesting conundrum to know what's going on with this. It would not, if you read her and didn't know her biography, you would think, oh, maybe she's a Christian existentialist. Maybe she's following in the steps of Kierkegaard or following even in the steps or leading the way toward a Bonhoeffer or someone like that. But I'm she is closely associated with those ideas, no doubt. But she's, you know, she's Jewish. She's just Jewish. And I don't mean religiously Jewish. So, but there's nothing you ever read from her that says, oh, I don't believe in God. Let's just talk about this naturalistically. She's perfectly happy talking about God and eternity and talking about scriptures and using those things. And she knows them like the back of her hand. So she's trying to see where the realization of those things can come into effect in this actual world. So anyway, a proper, I think, title for her, or, you know, nomenclature at least, if we wanted to try to put her in a pigeonhole, would be existentialist phenomenologist. She's both. I know we don't like talking about phenomenology either because it's a very complex philosophy or philosophical concept, but for those of you who know philosophers' names, she literally studied under Martin Heidegger and Karl Jaspers, in Germany. So she was a top philosophical mind in the 20th century. And in the midst of all of that, of course, the Nazi regime comes into power, and she ends up having to flee first to France and then to America just for her own safety's sake. And what's interesting about this is that she is an existentialist, and that's obvious in her way of understanding freedom and all that kind of stuff. Again, we'll talk about all these details as I get into the actual content of what I want to describe. But existentialism is not the same thing as postmodernity. And in existentialism, there's a lot of isolation, a lot of freedom for the individual, a lot of anticipation of death and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's all that negative stuff. But a postmodern reading is different than that. A postmodern reading usually applies some kind of transformative perspective or context to some work and then interprets it in a way that probably wouldn't have originally been intended by the author, but makes sense in light of what that author said, or at least in light of what that text says. That's what a postmodern does. You don't have to be an existentialist to do that. They're not even related. I mean, chronologically, they're related, but they're not related ideologically. But what she seems to do with Augustine is a lot of a postmodern reading of Augustine. Now, again, I don't expect you to care about that lingo. I'm just making the point. There, Arendt's reading of Augustine is not her interpretation of a proper understanding of Augustine. It's her taking a problem that Augustine pointed out and wrestling with it herself for a reason that's important. And this is what I'm trying to get to today. I just want you to understand why I think this would be worth us doing. Because Arendt is trying to solve a problem that all of us need to solve in this world. Now, I will come back because I don't want to give up sort of explaining her technique of approaching this work. So if I need to, I'll drop this and just make the main point for today, and then we'll pick it up next time. But let me introduce just a little of what she's trying to do. So she's trying to take Augustine, you know, the text itself, the things that he wrote, and use it as an object that's available to her as a reader to figure out what it can contribute to the world that she lives in. That's what she's trying to do. And so she reads Augustine, and it comes across in reading her, you know, dissertation on Augustine as being postmodern. What she's doing, she uses the way Augustine struggles with the tension between certain ideas and ideals that he has to address her own struggles or our own parallel struggles between the idea or ideal that we have about Christ and Christianity and what we should be like as Christians in the world and the way it actually plays out in our society and our lives. And in this world of all worlds, we should appreciate the tension that exists there. So to be right to the point on this subject matter, she uses things in Augustine's struggles, like we were talking about a moment ago, how the commitment to eternity exists at the expense of our present commitment to grow in maturity and responsibility and love for the things God gives us in this world. So she uses things in Augustine's struggles where he recognizes that tension. I hope you heard it in that convoluted sentence that I just gave, the tension between our command to love the eternal, but also to pay attention to the things that are in this world and care about them in a growing way while we're in the world, at the same time we're letting go of it. That's confusing. And so what it comes down to, and especially in her understanding of it, is how do you grow in altruism? How do you grow in your love for others in the world? How do you grow in your concern and maturity in relating to others who are in this world and all of your discipline within this life without also becoming attached to this world or limited by the way that you're attached to this world? She wants to address also the struggles that she faces throughout her own life in this world, no matter what she's trying to do. I mean, and think about how appropriate this is. Here's a person whose mind is just brilliant, and she's giving herself to these abstract studies of philosophy that are very practical, though. They're phenomenological. They're not just abstract thoughts about logic and mathematics. They are very common sense, or at least natural language ways of looking at and understanding the most complex questions of the world. All of that's very heady stuff inside your head. At the same time she's doing all of that, she's watching Kristallnacht happen in Europe. She's watching the Holocaust begin to unfold in Europe. She's seeing the rise not of a quirky leader who happens to get blinded people to follow him. She's watching the rise of a majority sentiment in Europe become realized in the brutal treatment of people she knows we actually ought to love and care about. Something's up. Something's broken in the disconnect between this way of participating in the world by caring about the eternal and the things that actually happen in the material world around you, which affect everything you do, including your ability to think about that eternal world. So what she ends up having to address is the struggle that she faces throughout her own life in the world, in Europe, and then ultimately in America. Like, how can one live out the commitment we have to make to serve a society when that society is largely composed of those who are uninterested in being helped and actually aggressively seeking to judge you or to expel you or to exterminate you, which is what's going on with her during that time. But it's not just that context of the European Holocaust and the anti-Semitism that had come to a head during that time. It's not that, because she's very explicit, and she means this. You can tell in her life, she means this throughout her life. She doesn't just use Augustine's text to defend her own interest or to make her own case or to defend her own people. Remember, this is the woman who later writes Eichmann in Jerusalem about the trial of Adolf Eichmann in the consequence of the wake of the Nazi atrocities in World War II. So she does that. She has a connection with her people, the Jewish people, but she's very explicit about not spending her time living and writing solely about that. And that would be important to the concept in her book, overall concept in her book, which is what we're going to get to next time. So why she picks Augustine, and this is sort of speculative on my part, but it's consistent with that work that we're looking at, Love and St. Augustine, and also with the interpretation that the editors of that work, a couple of women named Scott and Stark, they also interpret it this way, because Augustine is the first serious Christian author to do philosophical introspection as a Christian theologian, philosopher, and practitioner. He's the first one to work things over in this way, and that's the world that Hannah Arendt would be able to connect with. So as we're working through this material, and if you'll endure with me through one more episode, we'll actually look at the content of it, some applications that come from it, which I think are fundamentally important, really critically fundamentally important. If you'll endure with me through that, I will just assure you that her reason for wanting to bring up all of this about the nature of love and the way we ought to live that out in this world, and her adamant statement that she's not doing it just to defend her people, just to defend the Jews after what they went through in the Holocaust, but for all of us to have a different understanding of the world, those two things are inseparable in this concept, which should make sense to us. Those of us especially who have committed ourselves to following the practices and teachings of Jesus himself, who said he did not come into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. And in those very statements is making the point that he's not here to find people in the world who need to be judged. They're already judged. They're already condemned. That he's here to find people in the world who need to be redeemed. And guess what? That's all of us. More next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.